justify their hatred.
Stop all Muslim immigration. Is that the best way to protect America and our economy from new terror attacks?
The fact of the matter is, these guys want to kill us. We have to fight them. And we have to support law enforcement who want to fight
them.
You know, Clinton goes all over the map here. We got to get these guys before they kill
innocent people. And that's got to be the last word.
If you are an 18 to 28-year-old Muslim man, then you should be strip searched.
So there's always confusion about Islam. Is it a religion of violence or peace?
Islam is a violent, I was going to say religion, but it's not a religion. It's a political system. It's a violent political system bent on the overthrow of the governments of the world and world domination.
In the years since the September 11th attacks, advocacy groups claim that the United States has witnessed an anti-Muslim and anti-Arab backlash. Issam Zayem is president of the Cleveland office of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE. Nationally, CARE has tracked a five-fold surge in civil rights complaints by Muslim Americans since 2001.
The atmosphere and the environment and the media had created a very false perception about Islam and Muslims, especially American Muslims. So we were all lumped in the categories of the fifth column or the terrorists. If you look into the major cities in the country, you will find that there has been major cases all over the country.
The Department of Justice is waging a deliberate campaign of arrest and detention to protect American lives. We're removing suspected terrorists who violate the law from our streets to prevent further terrorist attack. We believe we have Al-Qaeda membership in custody, and we will use every constitutional tool to keep suspected terrorists locked up.
The U.S. Department of Justice refuses to release the tally of how many people it has detained since the beginning of its so-called war on terror. From 2001 to 2003 alone, however, at least 27,000 Arabs and Muslims inside the United States were detained and interrogated by the FBI, and 7,000 arrested. 145,000 Arab and Muslim immigrants were questioned as part of a special registration program, and of those, nearly 14,000 had deportation proceedings started against them. Sami Hammoudi was a PhD student in applied anthropology and an instructor at the University of South Florida, the same university Youssef Megahed attended as an engineering student. He and his family had moved to Tampa from Palestine in 1992, so Sami could pursue his studies. In 2003, he was arrested as a co-conspirator in the Sami Al-Aryan case and charged with terrorism.
Today, the United States Department of Justice is announcing the indictment of Sami Al-Aryan and seven co-conspirators. All of the defendants, if convicted, face the potential of life sentences. Al-Aryan's U.S. associates and Palestinian Islamic Jihad members arrested today include Sami Hammoudi.
At the very beginning of the case, I thought that there are misunderstandings.
They came around 4 a.m., 4 in the morning. They just came knocking on the door very strongly, and my wife woke up and we opened the door. Then they came to me and said, "You are under arrest for charges of terrorism, for supporting terrorism."
Rabia Haddad came to the U.S. to study in 1980, fleeing the violent civil war in Lebanon. After a career with various aid organizations, in 1992, Haddad founded the Global Relief Foundation, or GRF. It became the second largest Islamic charity in the United States, providing aid to 680,000 people worldwide. In 2001, he was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan with his wife and four young children. He worked as the chairman of GRF and volunteered as an imam at the local mosque. 3 months after 9/11, the government designated his charity a terrorist entity.
They raided our offices December 14th. It was a Friday. And I remember coming home after the Friday prayer. I felt that I was being followed coming back from the mosque. But I didn't think, you know, I thought, well, if they're raiding our offices in Chicago, it's, I think, normal to put me under surveillance or, you know, whatever. But then maybe an hour after that, they knocked at my door and arrested me. And things went downhill from there.
The theory that gave, let's say, legitimacy to all, in their thought, to all of these actions was Muslims and Arabs are either terrorists or potential terrorists. So we have to do things to control these communities. And this is what they did. And this is what they are still doing. Nothing changed.
Back in Tampa, Yusuf's court-appointed lawyer, Adam Allen, worried that the prevailing political and media climate would make his case nearly impossible to win.
Initially, obviously, when you are appointed to represent somebody from the Middle East originally, who is charged with the transportation of explosive materials, as a defense lawyer, you have some great concerns about the ability to successfully represent this individual. The media reaction was that this was some sort of terrorist-related activity. The United States Attorney's Office, although not saying that, certainly wasn't saying it wasn't. And that sort of swelled around this case.
Gary Meringer served as the foreman of the jury in Yusuf Mugahid's trial. He says the tone for the trial was set on the very first day.
The judge asked, does anybody here consider themselves an expert with explosives? And then, and he followed that with, is anybody here fluent in Arabic? And not knowing at all, when you go into being paneled on a jury, you don't know anything about the case. Just some person sitting there in a business suit, and all of a sudden I'm hearing Arabs and explosives, and it was like, whoa.
I mean, if you ask the man on the street, hey, the defendant's from the Middle East, and the government's alleging he's got explosive materials in his trunk, all of my colleagues said, there's no way you're going to win this at trial.
We listened to almost two full weeks of evidence. 40-plus witnesses were put on by the government. I don't know how many documents. It was, I think, over 100.
As the evidence came in, and it kept pointing away from Yusuf, and it kept showing that, you know, if even though there was no physical evidence tying him to it, once it became clear that these items were completely harmless, I felt we should win at trial, and we could win at trial.
The jury, after 3 days of looking hard and fast at the evidence, said, you know, it's the burden of the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was in possession of these materials and that he knew it. It's not sufficient that you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. You're not guilty of a crime in this country. And there was, the feeling was, you know, there really wasn't any evidence of that.
When the verdict was not guilty, it was a wonderful feeling. There were tears from the client and the family, and probably the best hug I've ever received from my client's father. Several of the agents that worked for the FBI came up and congratulated us and told us that they were not dissatisfied with the verdict in the case. And it was good to know. And I think I was even quoted in the paper as saying, you know, the system worked. As a lawyer who tries cases and understands the Constitution and the purpose of jury trials and the whole notion that the jury is the true representation of our government, it's a check on our government, and it's what makes us America, is that it's not the government that decides whether somebody's guilty. It's the community, because we are government of the people. And the people in this case, despite all the government's best efforts, said, you know what, you're wrong. It was about one of the proudest days I've ever had as a lawyer professionally. It was wonderful.
We went in and talked to the judge. He counseled us never to talk to anybody ever again about anything that had happened. And as a result of that, we all took all of our notes and all the charts and everything, and we just gave them to the bailiff to shred and burn, and thinking we would never, ever revisit this.
Well, he was acquitted of federal explosive charges just this past Friday, but today Yusuf Mugahid is back in the hands of federal agents, and his family tonight is outraged.
On Friday, after a three-week trial, Yusuf Mugahid walked out of a Tampa courthouse a free man.
I'm very happy.
Mugahid was acquitted on all counts of federal explosives charges, but his freedom was short-lived. Monday, to the surprise of his father, Megahead was arrested all over again.
They arrest my son. They kidnap my son.
Samir Megahead, Yusuf's father, says they were walking out of this Walmart on Bruce B. Downs when more than a dozen customs enforcement agents surrounded them.
They separated between me and my son, and they surround me. I tried to use the telephone. They didn't allow me to use the telephone and put the Yusuf in a small car. I tried to stop in front of this car to let Yusuf to speak to his lawyer. They didn't allow me to do this thing. They kidnapped my son.
I would have personally walked him to wherever he needed to be, but instead they chose to surveil him for days after the trial and to arrest him and his father as they are walking out of a grocery store, and to surround them by cars and agents and whisk him away in a vehicle.
Tuesday morning, I got to work. I opened up my browser, pulled up the news, and I saw that Yusuf had been arrested on Monday at a Walmart with his dad by immigration authorities. And this has only happened, and I was thinking about this morning, when I saw the Grand Canyon was another example, but where the air got sucked out of my lungs. I read the story and was like, like that. It just was so improbable. After all the time we had spent to find out that he hadn't done anything.
I spend a lot of my time telling the government they're wrong. That's what federal public defenders do. We tell the government they're wrong, and we argue that they're wrong, and we argue what they're trying to do to our clients is wrong. But we respect the system, and we were a part of the system, and we believe in the system. At that moment in time, not only did I not want to be a part of the system, but I didn't want to be an American. I was no longer proud of our system, and I was certainly not proud of our government.
Many a time, you know, I'd be sitting in my cell all alone, and I would have this slit in the wall that was about maybe 5 inches wide. That was the only window to the outside world. I would only see shadows and, you know, the colors of the sunset, but never really the sun. And I would sit there and wonder if I'm ever going to see a sunset again.
Of course, to this day, not a single charge has been filed against GRF or against any of the employees of GRF, including myself.
I was acquitted from all charges, and in the media, the jurors were saying that we didn't know why they brought him to the case. They took the first decision in half an hour. They voted without any discussion that I was innocent of all charges.
They didn't have enough to bring criminal charges, to charge me as a criminal, as a terrorist. The only accusation they would make against me is that I had overstayed my visa.
I was acquitted. The second day in the morning, ICE came. My attorney asked the judge to release me, but the judge wouldn't accept that.
The lawyer had told them that, like, he should be out in, like, 2 or 3 days, just until they process the paperwork and everything. And we kept waiting, and then they transferred him to the immigration facility. And every time we would keep trying, like, for the first, I think, week or two, like, even, like, my dad's lawyer couldn't get any information on what's going on. It wasn't something that was, like, unheard of, and it wasn't something like that I thought couldn't ever happen, because I saw it happen, or I've heard of it happening, but it was just, I didn't expect it to happen to my father.
I was denied bond based on the fact that they considered me a danger to the community. When my whole community was actually demonstrating and protesting and what have you. And they were treating me like the most dangerous, worst criminal ever. When I was taken from my cell to my first immigration hearing, the security they had was unbelievable. They had a sheriff's deputy stationed almost every 10 feet all the way from the door of my cell to the building almost next door. My trial was behind closed doors. I was put in solitary confinement on a floor all by myself in very tight, in a very tight cell. And they had a camera fixed right on me. The cell door had a small window, and the camera was right there. It was clear then that this wasn't about immigration or me overstaying my visa or anything like that. They were going after me with everything they got.
One time I passed through the room, observation room of the guard, and I saw my picture there. So I asked one of the guards why my picture is there. He said, because you are a threat, and we have to keep an eye over you for 24 hours. And this was from ICE. They gave them this information.
The thing that got to me the most was just not knowing, like not knowing what's going to happen, not knowing whether I'll be able to see him again, whether he'll, you know, just be there for like these major events in our lives.
Very quickly, we presented to ICE that I have a passport. I don't need a visa. I can go tomorrow to my country, and I am willing to do that. They said, no, we have to wait, we have to wait.
He would try appealing, and then there would be different court dates, and like nothing would come out of it, and then different promises. And then at the end, they told us, if you just leave voluntarily, we promised he'll be on the flight with you. We kept expecting to find my father there, and he didn't show up. At the end, the immigration officer told him, he's like, I can't respond to your questions anymore.
After almost 3 years in prison, two of those in solitary confinement, Sami Hammoudi was found innocent of all terrorism charges. But instead of being released, he was transferred to an immigration jail. For 6 months, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, refused to either release or deport him, even after he agreed to voluntary deportation to reunite with his family. Hammoudi's lawyers brought ICE to court. 2 days before the trial, Hammoudi was deported in secret.
So on the 23rd, they took me to the airport and deported me. So it wasn't their plan to deport me this way. If we didn't go to the federal judge and ask him to either release me or deport me, they wouldn't do that.
We didn't even know, because we were used to him calling, and then he didn't call for 2 days, so we didn't know what was going on. And my mom called his lawyer, and he didn't like have an idea of what's going on, and we kept trying to get in touch with people. And like she was kind of freaking out, because it was just, you couldn't get in touch with him. No one knew what was happening to him.
It's the humiliation of, you know, being deported and traveling in a T-shirt and sweatpants and prison shoes and having these agents with you. It's especially for somebody who has, my good name and my reputation are the only assets I have in this world. I mean, you know, I don't have any money in any bank accounts. I don't have any land. I don't have any. But this is the only thing I have. And the U.S. government made sure to attack me on these two. They have ruined my reputation. They have ruined my good name. And they have accused me unjustly of things that are complete fabrications. They could not prove anything because there was nothing there. But with the USA Patriot Act, they didn't have to prove anything. It was enough for the government to say, we suspect.
They think that accusing people, destroying their lives, is something they can do. This is what worries me. It is the arrogance of the powerful.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Over the course of this summer, the nation has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The article you're about to hear has been published in the opinion section of the New York Times. The piece is titled, Donald Trump is Not Above the Law, and it's been written by the editorial board of the newspaper. Over the course of this summer, America has been transfixed by the House Select Committee's hearings on the events of 6th of January 2021 and how or whether Donald Trump might face accountability for what happened on that day. The Justice Department remained largely silent about its investigations of the former president until this month, when the FBI searched his home in Palm Beach, Florida, in a case related to his handling of classified documents. The spectacle of a former president facing criminal investigation raises profound questions about American democracy, and these questions demand answers. Donald Trump's unprecedented assault on the integrity of American democracy requires a criminal investigation. The disturbing details of his post-election malfeasance, meticulously assembled by the January 6th committee, leave little doubt that Mr. Trump sought to subvert the Constitution and overturn the will of the American people. The president, defeated at the polls in 2020, tried to enlist federal law enforcement authorities, state officials, and administrators of the nation's electoral system in a furious effort to remain in power. When all else failed, he roused an armed mob that stormed the Capitol and threatened lawmakers. The Justice Department is reportedly examining Mr. Trump's conduct, including his role in trying to overturn the election and in taking home classified documents. If Attorney General Merrick Garland and his staff conclude that there is sufficient evidence to establish Donald Trump's guilt on a serious charge in a court of law, then they must seek an indictment too. This board is aware that in deciding how Donald Trump should be held accountable under the law, it is necessary to consider not just whether criminal prosecution would be warranted, but whether it would be wise. No American president has ever been criminally prosecuted after leaving office. When President Gerald Ford pardoned Richard Nixon, he ensured that Nixon would not be prosecuted for crimes committed during the Watergate scandal. Gerald Ford explained his decision with the warning that such a prosecution posed grave risks of rousing ugly passions and worsening political polarization. That warning is just as salient today. Pursuing prosecution of Donald Trump could further entrench support for him and play into the conspiracy theories he has sought to stoke. It could inflame the bitter partisan divide, even to the point of civil unrest. A trial, if it is viewed as illegitimate, could also further undermine confidence in the rule of law, whatever the eventual outcome. The risks of political escalation are obvious. The Democratic and Republican parties are already in the thick of a cycle of retribution that could last generations. There is a substantial risk that, if the Justice Department does prosecute Donald Trump, future presidents, whether Mr. Trump himself or someone of his ilk, could misuse the precedent to punish political rivals. If their party takes a majority in the House of Representatives after the midterm elections, some Republicans have already threatened to impeach President Biden. There is an even more immediate threat of further violence, and it is a possibility that Americans should, sadly, be prepared for. In the hours after federal agents began a court-approved search of Donald Trump's residence in Palm Beach, based on a warrant investigating possible violations of three federal laws, including one that governs the handling of defense information under the Espionage Act, his most fervent supporters escalated their rhetoric to the language of warfare. As the New York Times noted, the aggressive widespread response was arguably the clearest outburst of violent public rhetoric since the days leading up to the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol. Merrick Garland has been deliberate, methodical, and scrupulous in his leadership of the Justice Department's investigation of the January 6th attack and the transfer of documents to Donald Trump's home. On Friday, a redacted version of the affidavit used to obtain the warrant was released, revealing that the Justice Department asked to search the premises to recover documents because of concerns that their disclosure could compromise clandestine human sources of intelligence, and because it had probable cause to believe it would find evidence of obstruction at the premises. No matter how careful Merrick Garland is, or how measured the prosecution might be, there is a real and significant risk from those who believe that any criticism of Donald Trump justifies an extreme response. Yet, it is a far greater risk to do nothing when action is called for. Aside from letting Mr. Trump escape punishment, doing nothing to hold him accountable for his actions in the months leading up to the January 6th assault could set an irresistible precedent for future presidents. Why not attempt to stay in power by any means necessary, or use the power of the office to enrich oneself or punish one's enemies, knowing that the law does not apply to presidents in or out of office? More importantly, democratic government is an ideal that must constantly be made real. America is not sustained by a set of principles. It is sustained by resolute action to defend those principles. Immediately after the January 6th insurrection, Cabinet members reportedly debated privately whether to remove Donald Trump from power under the authority of the 25th Amendment. A week after the attack, the House impeached Mr. Trump for the second time. This editorial board supported his impeachment and removal from office. We also suggested that the former president and lawmakers who participated in the January 6th plot could be permanently barred from holding office under a provision of the 14th Amendment that applies to any official who has engaged in insurrection or rebellion, or given aid or comfort to those who have done so. But most Republicans in the Senate refused to convict Donald Trump, and Congress has yet to invoke that section of the 14th Amendment against him. As a result, the threat that Donald Trump and his most ardent supporters pose to American democracy has metastasized. Even now, the former president continues to spread lies about the 2020 election and denounce his vice president, Mike Pence, for not breaking the law on his behalf. Meanwhile, dozens of people who believe Mr. Trump's lies are running for state and national elected office. Many have already won, some of them elevated to positions that give them control over how elections are conducted. In June, the Republican Party in Texas approved measures in its platform declaring that Mr. Biden's election was illegitimate. And Donald Trump appears prepared to start a bid for a second term as president. Mr. Trump's actions as a public official, like no other since the Civil War, attack the heart of our system of government. He used the power of his office to subvert the rule of law. If we hesitate to call those actions and their perpetrator criminal, then we are saying he's above the law and giving license to future presidents to do whatever they want. In addition to a federal investigation by the Justice Department, Donald Trump is facing a swirl of civil and criminal liability in several other cases. A lawsuit by the Attorney General for the District of Columbia over payments during his inauguration ceremonies. A criminal investigation in Westchester County, New York, over taxes on one of his golf courses. A criminal case in Fulton County, Georgia, over interference in the 2020 presidential election. A criminal case by the Manhattan District Attorney over the valuation of Mr. Trump's properties. And a civil inquiry by New York's Attorney General into Donald Trump and the Trump Organization. The specific crimes the Justice Department could consider would likely involve Mr. Trump's fraudulent efforts to get election officials in Georgia, in Arizona, and elsewhere, to declare him the winner, even though he lost in those states. To get Mike Pence, at the 6th of January congressional certification of the election, to throw out slates of electors from states he lost and replace them with electors loyal to Mr. Trump. And to enlist officials from the Department of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Department of Defense, the Pentagon, to persuade officials in certain states to swing the election to him and ultimately stir up a mob that attacked the Capitol. The government could also charge Mr. Trump with seditious conspiracy, a serious charge that federal prosecutors have already brought against leaders of far-right militia groups who participated in the Capitol invasion. The committee hearings make it clear Mr. Trump must have known he was at the center of a frantic, sprawling, and knowingly fraudulent effort that led directly to the Capitol siege. For hours, Donald Trump refused to call off the mob. The testimony from hundreds of witnesses, many of them high-ranking Republican officials from his own administration, reveals Donald Trump's unrelenting efforts, beginning months before Election Day and continuing through 6th of January, to sow doubt about the election, to refuse to accept the result of that election, and then to pursue what he must have known were illegal and unconstitutional means to overturn it. Many participants sought preemptive pardons for their conduct, an indication that they knew very well that they were violating the law. Other evidence points to other crimes like obstruction of Congress, defined as a corrupt obstruction of the proper administration of the law. The fake elector scheme that Mr. Trump and his associates pushed before January 6 appears to meet this definition. That may explain why at least three of Mr. Trump's campaign lawyers were unwilling to participate in the plot. People involved in it were told it was not legally sound by White House lawyers, but they moved forward with it anyway. Cassidy Hutchinson, a top aide to Mr. Trump's last chief of staff, Mark Meadows, provided powerful evidence that could be used to charge Donald Trump with seditious conspiracy. In her public testimony at a January 6 committee hearing, Cassidy Hutchinson said that Mr. Trump was informed that many in the throng of supporters waiting to hear him speak on the Ellipse on that day were armed, but that he demanded that they be allowed to skip the metal detectors that had been installed for his security. "They're not here to hurt me," he said, according to Ms. Hutchinson. "Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here." If Merrick Garland decides to pursue prosecution, a message that the Justice Department must send early and often is that even if Mr. Trump genuinely believed, as he claimed, that the election had been marred by fraud, his schemes to interfere in the certification of the vote would still be crimes. And even though Mr. Trump's efforts failed, these efforts would still be crimes. More than 850 other Americans have already been charged with crimes for their roles in the Capitol attack. Well-meaning intentions did not shield them from the consequences of their actions. It would be unjust if Donald Trump, the man who inspired them, faced no consequences. No one should revel in the prospect of this or any former president facing criminal prosecution. Donald Trump's actions have brought shame on America and destabilized its future. Even justice before the law will not erase that stain. Nor will prosecuting Mr. Trump fix the structural problems that led to the greatest crisis in American democracy since the Civil War. But it is a necessary first step toward doing so.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and to you too.
Dear listeners, Brother Miqdad is Islamic researcher and teacher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. It's a pleasure to be with you, as always. Okay, brother, we said in previous sessions about the cons of social media, and guiding our teenagers about that is extremely important. So are there any more cons that we can educate our teenagers about?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We talked quite at length about self-esteem, mental issues, mental health issues that are associated with social media, with the users of social media. I could even say with the inefficient usage of social media. We also talked about poor relationship. Another one that's out there as well that you can search about is the lack of performance in education. Right? We find that social media is related to poor performance at school, and even sometimes decrease in cognitive tasks.
Okay.
One thing that's very famous, you've probably heard of this as well, is the attention span of today, right? Of our youth today. Attention span is our ability to concentrate on a particular matter. Okay. How long can we focus on a particular time? And obviously, the idea is that the more focused you are, the more time you can give to a particular task or a particular book or particular activity, in a focused manner, you are more efficient. You are
more productive.
Able to get more out of it.
Okay.
And so we find today one of the biggest challenges that we find at the level of education in children is that the attention span of not just youth, also adult, is very weak, right? So as a simple example, if I send you a video that is more than 2 minutes long, 2 minutes, right?
Okay.
You'll find that people swipe and just move on. They watch the first 10 seconds, watch the first 30 seconds. Don't have the patience, don't have the ability to bear that 2 minutes,
two minutes,
10 minutes to learn something. It has to be quick, it has to be now. It has to be, I only have a few seconds of attention span. And so this is a very big issue. It's a very big issue in education. It's a very big issue in different spheres because our efficiency becomes very less.
Yeah.
And our ability to increase knowledge, our ability to gain from the different things out there is very less. And this is why, for example, right now, teenagers and youth don't read books, because to read books, you need a very strong attention span.
Yeah.
Unless it's a comic or unless it's got something in it that drives us, whether it's sexual content, whether it's controversies or something that is
something entertaining
basically. But if it's a very important matter written in a very important, precise way, teenagers can't do it today.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the ability and the cognitive ability to focus and concentrate
attention
on a particular thing.
Yeah. All right. I have seen that even adults don't see the videos which are more than for 2 minutes, just because, as you rightly said, they want it now. They want it just that moment, without realizing that they spent hours on it and they can't even bear a video of more than 2 minutes. Well, brother, I'll be discussing with you about more cons after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. I'm with Brother Mikhtar, and we're talking about the cons we can teach our teenagers.
The last point hopefully regarding these negative points regarding social media, is the exposure to haram. So as Muslims, it is our duty to ensure that we avoid going into haram. And in fact, even more important is that we... what is very important for us to keep in mind is that we need to stay away to exposure towards haram, or stay away very far from the haram. It's like someone who's walking in a mountain, right? When you know the cliff is right there, and if you fall, it's going to be a disaster, taking away your life away. You're going to be standing quite far away from the cliff, right, or from the edge. Very few, or rather you would say it's very foolish to stand right at the edge, because something happens and you could fall. Best thing is always take a step away, a meter away from the edge. It gives you kind of precaution.
Yeah.
So with the haram, is same thing as well. We've been taught in Islam that don't live on the edge, right? Don't live in a place where any moment you could just fall into haram. No, take a step away and avoid exposing yourself to the possibility of committing haram. And we find that social media is a very... it's a platform where haram is very easy to happen. Very easy. Let me give you a couple of examples. So first, there is obviously interaction between genders, between mahram and non-mahram, whether it's looking at images that are inappropriate, or whether it's sharing and talking to the opposite gender in a way that is more than necessary, and therefore becomes haram if it leads to that which is not allowed for us to kind of have a ratio between a boy and a girl.
Okay.
But not just that, also haram content, whether it's images or if it's even words. So we're constantly bombarded with things that, with images, explicit or non-explicit, or even content, words, sentences that are of nature that is haram for us to read. And so this is something we need to take care of. And we don't have filters on our social media, and we very often fall into this. Now you can say, but I don't look at it, I don't spend time on it. It's true, but if you're constantly seeing the first sight and you know it happens on social media, then we need to be careful of that.
Okay, so just constantly that particular thing coming up for you over there can affect your mind.
That's correct.
Okay, so it's not just the content, the videos, the pictures. It's also the accessibility. It's an easy accessibility to all that haram content that's available over there. And just not only being available, it's also like being shown in a way like this is something that's right, this is something that's needed, this is something that can be used in your leisure time. So yes, there are a lot more things we can talk about that. And actually, the most important thing over here, after knowing so many cons, is how do we deal that? And I would definitely want to know from you about that. How do we deal with all that? After a short break, dear listeners, stay connected to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "He who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Brother Miqdad, and we are talking about some of the cons of social media that need to be guided to our teenagers. Brother Miqdad, you were talking about the haram content that's easily accessible, that's available there, that we need to be careful of.
So other things that perhaps we might not have thought about that is also haram. So for example, spreading false rumors. So spreading false rumors is haram. We find that on social media, it's very common.
Yeah.
You hear something and very quickly you forward it. Not having checked, is this correct? Is this wrong? Is this correct? Is it right? Is it dealing with somebody else's private life? Am I backbiting? Or am I being blasphemous regarding certain things that are related to personal lives? Or just false information? Am I somebody who's spreading false information? These things all are haram.
Okay.
But unfortunately, on social media, as we go on and either press a like button or forward it to others, etc. This, we're part of a movement that involves haram, and we need to be careful of that.
All right. So do you think, like, for example, this also comes in it? For example, sometimes someone sends you a voice note or sends you some kind of picture, and we trust that that particular person is sending all that to you only. But you, when you're kind of close, your close friend is someone else, you're trying to forward all those voice messages, all those pictures to that best friend or so-called best friend without the permission of the other person at the party.
Yes, exposing other people's secrets is something as well that we have. We have that when you have a discussion between two individuals, the content of the discussion should never be spread without the approval of that those two individuals.
But sometimes, like, they are especially teens who try to prove themselves that I am right and send screenshots here and there. And sending screenshots is also done without the permission.
Exactly. So it's kind of opening up secrets of other people, which is not correct.
Okay.
Other things that could be haram over here. One of them is making fun of others. So again, something that we do this perhaps often on social media is to make fun of others, mock each other.
Yeah.
And perhaps the other person might not show that they mind, but they might feel really bad. It might have impacts in their lives, in how they think about themselves.
And the self-esteem.
Exactly. And so this is counted as a sin. To mock somebody, to mock another believer, to make fun of is something that is haram and we need to be careful of. Another is mocking and making fun of the religion or personalities related to religion. You find that we make fun of Islam, or we make fun of scholars, we make fun of individuals or things related to the religion in the name of joke or in the name of just a laugh. But these things can be haram if it leads to humiliating, degrading, looking down upon the religion or the people involved in, or people, personalities related to religion, or even things related to the religion. So we need to be very careful about these things. Now, okay. there is more as well. So another one, for example, let me mention one last one, is the use of foul language. So swearing, bad language, foul language. So using foul language is something that's not permissible in Islam. And this is something that's not something that's a believer with all the dignity that he has to use such language, basically.
All right. So we talked about so many cons about the social media that we can be, we have to educate our teenagers. Now, what can we do about that? I'll ask you that in another session. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to Islamic Upbringing. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for us, please feel free to contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can listen to this program again on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.